It's to the best of our knowledge from PRX. I'm Ann Strandchamps. Do you ever get the feeling that your digital devices are eavesdropping on you?
How can I help you?
We were standing in my office, and we were just having one of these conversations that's really boring but necessary about needing to replace the water heater in our house.
This is public radio listener Carrie Ness Nesha. She lives in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And after the conversation was finished, my husband left for work, and I just turned around and logged into my computer and was starting my work day, and I noticed an ad on the right side of my screen for a water heater. I'm actually sort of an Apple junkie, so I've got a MacBook, an iPad, and an iPhone. We have Apple TV. We have the whole suite of products from that particular company. We sort of had this light bulb go on. It was like, oh, our devices are listening to us.
No problem.
And we have noticed it happening more frequently. We had posted a picture of us having a champagne toast. And the label of the champagne bottle was in the picture. We noticed ads the next day for that brand of champagne in particular showing up in our Facebook feeds. We got an American Girl doll from Grandma and Grandpa sent to our daughter for Christmas. And all of a sudden we're seeing all of these ads for American Girl dolls. We've always known that we were sort of under surveillance by having all of these devices in our home. To have it come from something I'm just saying out loud inside my own office, that's a little disconcerting.
You're welcome.
So this is the world we live in now, a world in which we're being watched and listened to constantly, not by sinister Russian spies, but by our very own phones, computers, and TVs. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Randolph Lewis is the author of Under Surveillance, Being Watched in Modern America.
The great infrastructure of the 21st century, I think, is surveillance. It's how corporations find out intimate details about us that they use for marketing purposes. It's how governments determine whether we're a risk or a good citizen or a threat to the nation and so forth. They call it ubiquitous surveillance. Mm. I mean, it's just everywhere all the time. In the background, kind of like autonomously running these days.
And growing all the time. I mean, new kinds of surveillance technology are constantly being developed. What are some of the most surprising examples that you've discovered?
That was one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because it felt like every day I was struck in the face by some news story about the latest surveillance technology. I think in the last week, the digital pills, this kind of biomedical Big Brother apparatus was approved.
Wait, what is that?
It's a pill the doctor gives you. Unlike most pills, which you can either take or not take at your discretion, this one has a way to send a signal back through Bluetooth, I guess, through your phone, but then ultimately to your doctor and maybe your insurance company. And it's designed for schizophrenics at first to make sure they're taking their medicine.
Wow.
So it is kind of ironic that schizophrenia tends towards paranoia and delusions.
You think you're being watched.
Right.
Right. Turns out you are.
Right. It's the old Delmore Schwartz quote that even paranoids have real enemies. You know, so it's, maybe it is benign to have a medication that you're taking and your doctor is seeing, okay, good, this has been ingested on schedule. And maybe in the case of some individuals, it's really helpful to be able to look over their shoulder and make sure that they're taking it. But what I wrote this book for really is to think through the implications of things like this. I mean, this happened after the book came out a couple months ago. But I mean, what are the implications if all our medication has this kind of digital quality and that the insurance company knows infinitely more about what I'm taking and putting in my body? I find, as someone who's really has a kind of like investment in liberty and autonomy and independence, I find those things very threatening to not just my psychological well-being, but kind of the healthy functioning of a democracy.
Yeah, and also just psychologically, you're swallowing a bug. Essentially, you're being bugged from inside your own body.
Yeah.
I was surprised recently to read that smart speakers like Amazon's Echo and Google Home, that those are actually recording our voices even when we're not talking to them. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. I was just having dinner last night with a cybersecurity expert who spent a lot of time trying to find a dumb TV. He didn't want a smart TV because the smart TVs are picking up all the audio in the house so that they can be controlled through voice commands and for gaming purposes and other benign purposes. But this became a little bit of a scandal about 2 years ago when Samsung released a smart TV that people were very excited to buy and put in their home, but they didn't realize on page 44 or something in the fine print of the instructions that Samsung was recording everything that was within range of the microphone on the TV. That data was going back to Samsung and then to an unnamed third party, probably a marketing company, but who knows?
I think a standard response to some of this is you don't really need to worry about surveillance if you have nothing to hide. I mean, the surveillance is there to catch people committing crimes. So how do you respond to that defense?
Yeah, I hear that a lot when I talk to people. I have nothing to hide. And I think it really is one of the most naive and disingenuous phrases in the English language right now. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg puts tape over his webcam on his laptop. We all have something to hide. The journalist Glenn Greenwald has kind of thrown down the gauntlet and he said, if you have nothing to hide, why don't you send me, Glenn Greenwald, all of your passwords and all of your information, and you know, I'll go through all of your emails and see what I can see. And of course, nobody does that. We all have things we want to keep private, whether they're medical things, things in our romantic life. Privacy is important to people once they start to think about losing it and what it really means. So I think I have nothing to hide is often correlated with certain kinds of privilege. And I was sitting around a table with some freshmen at the University of Texas here in Austin. Four of them were telling me, well, I don't feel like I have anything to hide. I feel like surveillance is not that big a deal. The fifth person at the table, the only person of color, an African-American woman, said, I hate it. Every time I go into a store, I feel like I'm being followed, I'm being tracked. So there was a kind of biographical element to surveillance consciousness and whether you feel disconcerted by this feeling and this reality often of someone looking over your shoulder.
Mm-hmm. There has been, of course, a lot of discussion and still will be about the moral and legal issues around surveillance culture, but you are more interested in what you call the soft tissue damage that surveillance inflicts on us. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a phrase that I use to try to describe something that goes beyond the kind of normal conversation we have with surveillance, which is about law, policy, technology, and those sorts of things that law school professors might write about very well. For me, I was interested in more of the kind of ethical, the emotional qualities, the aesthetic qualities. One of the chapters in the book is about churches who are wiring up for maximum surveillance to prevent crime within sanctuaries. And that may be perfectly reasonable from a perspective that some of these churches have, but you look at a CCTV camera above an altar and it looks strange.
Yeah.
I went to Catholic school and it looks strange to me. It's like, which one is the real authority in the room symbolically?
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that. I was thinking more along the lines of church is a place people are supposed to go to be with their most private selves. I mean, think of the confessional, for instance. There's a reason it's private and secret and nobody's supposed to be able to see you. So to install security cameras all over a church just seems like an oxymoron.
It does to me, too. But not everyone feels that way. And there's a big business in what I call sacred security. And I was sort of tracking that. How people experience that varies infinitely. But, you know, the soft tissue damage that I'm writing about is trying to figure out the really subtle impacts of surveillance culture. When we have a car accident, you know, it's like the broken bones are really obvious, but the soft tissue damage keeps going on and on. It's really nuanced and lingers. And so I was trying to figure out, well, what that might be over time, living in a culture of unprecedented and increasingly invasive monitoring. I think if there's a key word in this book, and it's one that, as a cultural historian, a writer, somebody who writes about culture, I'm really reluctant to use, which is unprecedented. But I do think the elements have come together technologically and politically and culturally to create a truly unprecedented situation in which surveillance is really at the heart of so much of what's going on today.
What are some examples of that soft tissue damage you're concerned about?
I guess I could answer it personally. I have a chapter in the book which is about memoir and surveillance, about why some people develop certain kinds of sensitivities and anxieties around it. There's no coincidence that we're living in an age of profound anxiety and record numbers of prescriptions for anxiety and a real spike in social anxiety disorders. It's unpleasant to feel watched for many people. And some people have the wonderful ability just to be blasé and tune it out. And I write about some people like that. But many others feel the burden of it just weighing down on them. And so they walk into a room and they see the CCTV camera. And rather than feeling protected and comforted by this kind of security apparatus, they feel weighed down by the feeling that perhaps something bad happened in this space and they had to put the camera in because something awful once transpired here. There's so many little ways in which surveillance can cut us throughout the day. And it plays out differently for people of different races and gender as well. I go through the TSA and I dislike it. I feel like it's security theater and it doesn't really bother me tremendously on a kind of bodily level. But there are a lot of women, and I write about some of them in the book, who feel like there's a kind of ogling going on and some TSA screeners have gotten into trouble for applying sort of like code words to attractive females coming into the scanning devices.
Wow. I have to say, as a woman, when the TSA, the full body scanners first came in, it felt very invasive and weird to me. And I thought, can you see my body under my clothes? And how much can you see? And then the TSA would come out and say, no, we really can't see that much. Huh. And now, because you can't say no, so I guess I just try not to think about it.
And that is the solution for a lot of people. And I understand that we're overwhelmed by so many other issues. But, you know, just on the issue of gender and surveillance, I mean, just in recent weeks, when you look at Louis C.K. and Matt Lauer and Roy Moore and the kind of culture of patriarchy and privilege and abuse that is inherent in what's been going on there, you think, would you trust these people with the keys to an incredibly powerful monitoring system? Does our culture respect women in a way that it makes us feel like these kinds of systems would not be abused in sexist ways? There have been lawsuits against casinos for the employees using CCTV for ogling women. Police have been in trouble for the same thing. The NSA even has a word called love int. It's the love intel. It's the abuse of their systems to look up ex-lovers and to kind of track people down.
Oh, wow.
Then there's another creepy word called pervalence, which is the use of all these cameras and monitoring devices for ogling and sexual gratification and voyeurism.
How much does that go on, do you think?
More than we realize. I hate to say it, but, you know, a lot of people working behind the desks in these security jobs are young men and they're bored and they sit there all day. And they do, unfortunately, what a lot of young men do, which is kind of objectify women. And they've got a machine that allows them to do it. There's been research that shows, this was back in the 1990s in Europe, a researcher showed that the surveillance cameras that were put into, I think it was in a shopping mall, were being used more for sexual gratification, ogling, than they were for security.
Wow.
And so if you could actually look over the shoulder of Big Brother and see what he was looking at, you'd probably be pretty disturbed.
Kind of makes you want to go home, turn off everything electronic, and pull the shades, doesn't it? Randolph Lewis tells more stories about how we're being watched in a book called Under Surveillance.
I'll be watching you.
Now that we're all feeling insecure, it's probably a good time for a quick lesson in online privacy, how to protect yourself and your phone from hackers, trolls, and scammers. And for that, Steve Paulson called Lily Hay Newman, the staff writer who covers security for Wired.
What are some of the risks that having a smartphone carries?
Well, it's just like the capabilities of a smart home device or a smart assistant, but sort of even more expanded. It has listening capabilities, right? You know, it has a microphone. Potentially malware or spyware on the device could see everything that you're doing, everything that you're typing, harvest passwords.
Wait, even when the phone is not on, you're saying all this stuff can be activated?
my smartphone's on all the time.
Okay.
Right? Don't we have our phones on all the time? Yeah. I mean, if you turn the phone off, it's more limited. There are still some mostly theoretical but kind of amazing, incredible things that could be done more with airplane mode. There are some attacks, like the microphone being a good example, right? The microphone doesn't need an internet connection. So even if you cut the data connectivity and the Wi-Fi connectivity, it could still listen, store, and then send back data to wherever it's calling home to when you do eventually reconnect. When it's totally off, there are, you know, a couple things, but yeah, totally off is pretty good, except that, like I said, we all keep our smartphones on all the time.
Who wants to turn them off? That sort of defeats the point.
You know? Yeah. So that's why I was describing it that way, is just I think of it as an always-on device. Hmm. And I do have an always-on device with me all the time, which is my smartphone.
So assuming we do have a smartphone, we do leave it on, are there any basic preventive steps we might want to take just to be a little safer?
Yeah, I think with all our devices, because, right, our laptops, when we're using them, are a lot like smartphones. They have a front-facing camera, they have a microphone, an internet connection, a lot of the same attributes. They are both computing devices. There are sort of a couple basic ones that I think about. One is encrypted messaging. You know, this is something people are talking about more and more. Certain messaging services offer what's called end-to-end encrypted messaging, which sort of means that your texts or your messages or your photos or things that you are sending back and forth to people are kind of in a protected tunnel all the way between your devices. And the data is only decrypted so that it is human readable at your end where you sent it and at their end where they received it on their device. And all along the digital tunnel that the data moves through between the two devices, wherever it goes, whatever servers it stops at on the way, it's not readable and it's not decryptable. So end-to-end encrypted messaging is a great tool. You know, now the end-to-end encrypted messaging services that are available are very easy to use.
Hmm. So, because that sounds really complicated, what you just described.
The way the messaging services are now set up, you don't need to do anything or know about anything. You just need to choose to use a service that provides it over a service that doesn't.
Hmm. Okay.
So, right, the easy one being WhatsApp.
Mm-hmm.
WhatsApp offers end-to-end encrypted messaging for, I think, 1 billion users.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of unbelievable and amazing.
You've written about what we can do to protect ourselves from phishing attacks, basically scams that are used to get us to reveal personal information. Can you talk about that?
Phishing is really difficult to combat because the whole goal of it, the only point of it, the only thing that's happening is that someone is trying to trick you. So if you get tricked, it's really understandable because one or many people spent a lot of time trying to do that, right?
So give me a couple examples of how this works.
So one classic one would be, you won a free cruise, click here to claim it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You click the thing and it takes you to a page that says, okay, enter your name and address and phone number. It's a free cruise. But you have to pay the tax, and the tax costs $100. So enter your credit card, and then you get this free cruise for $100. And you're like, heck yeah. And then suddenly your credit card's been stolen. You know, that's like the most basic example. But that's not even a very good fish, particularly anymore, for a lot of reasons, right? You're very skeptical that someone would give you a free cruise. If it's free, why do I have to pay something? All that stuff. So that's not a great fish. A better fish would be a really good-looking, very official-looking email that says, your credit card on your Lyft account has expired. Click here to go to your account, and we'll smooth it out. We'll fix it. We'll deal with it. But it looks just like the emails you get from that service. You know, it could be anything.
Right. I get those emails that I'm not sure. I mean, they say they're from my work. You know, I'm part of a big institution, University of Wisconsin. I sometimes can't tell whether they're really from my work.
You might get an email from your boss's boss. mm-hmm. that says, hey, I want to talk to you. Can you put into this form what day would work for you, you know, in a Google Calendar or something? In that situation, you might be clicking the link which initiates a malware download. Sometimes they're trying to harvest your information and get you to voluntarily get tricked into entering your username and password. And sometimes they're trying to get you to click a link to take you to a malicious site that initiates a download to try to lace your device with malware.
Mm-hmm.
So the things to think about with phishing, the main one that's resonated for me is just urgency. Anytime a message is urgently telling you to do something, really need you to sign up for a time slot to meet with me, or really, if you don't act now, the cruise will be gone,
right.
Or you only have 10 days to change your credit card number or your account will be suspended. Those types of things should really be a red flag to just take a second and say, oh, I'm feeling so motivated to do this right now. Like, we're all procrastinators. Come on. If you're feeling motivated to do something at that very moment, just take a second to think about whether or not it's real. You know, so in the case of your boss's boss, isn't it kind of weird that your boss's boss is like directly emailing you? You could verify with them. You could check and say, hey, did you send me an email about setting up a time? Okay. And then if it's true and they
yeah.
did, you
mm-hmm.
say, okay, cool. I'll choose a time slot now. But just having that moment to check, Lyft is not going to cancel your account. They don't want to lose
right.
you as a customer. They're not going to give you 5 days to, you know, you can have as long as you want to fix your credit card. They just don't want you to leave. So that sense of urgency, it's been helpful to me to think of that as a big tip off. And then just never click links in emails unless you're completely sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's a legitimate, right? That's the classic one. Just
yeah.
don't click, don't download attachments. Be really conscious and deliberate about doing those types of things. And just following your gut. A lot of times when people accidentally fall into the trap and get phished, they're sort of kicking themselves because they're like, I knew it was weird that
right.
that person
right.
had emailed me, or I knew I had just fixed my credit card in that account the other day, or I just fixed my mailing address or something. So I knew it was a little strange. And it's really hard. Like I said, I have a lot of sort of infinite sympathy about this. And for myself, I'm always worried I'm going to get phished, because there's no goal other than tricking you. All the resources are going into trying to trick you. So if it happens, it's understandable. But those are the things that you can do to try to be conscious and aware.
You know, this strikes me as kind of a never-ending battle. And the odds are, it seems like they're always going to be stacked against us, because there is going to be ever more sophisticated technology out there. The people trying to scam us or hack us or surveil us are going to use. Does it sort of feel like a hopeless cause to you to keep on top of these things?
I do think that digital surveillance is extremely powerful. And there are some things that you don't know until later that you would have wanted to protect. And that's definitely the hardest part, is that it's not until you're in a really messy divorce or
mm-hmm,
something
right.
that you realize that, you know, maybe you should have kept something a little bit quieter than you did. But I do feel heartened that once you're aware of this stuff as a concern, for the most sensitive things, for your sort of darkest secrets, you can make decisions that can protect those things. For example, if there's something that you just really wouldn't want anyone to know, it might not even be bad. It might just be personal.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't type it anywhere. You know, you could still talk to people about it. Or if you do, think carefully about where you put it. I also think a lot about data that is stored locally on our devices, meaning only saved in the hard drive or the flash storage or the memory of that device,
mm-hmm.
versus data that is stored in the cloud. I think the cloud is very secure, can be very secure. You know, there's not anything inherently wrong with the cloud, But another thing to consider is just that concept of local versus cloud.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you have a spreadsheet of just all the people you hate most and everything they've ever done to wrong you. Personally, I wouldn't store that spreadsheet in the cloud. I would store it locally on a device that only I own. And if you want to go really hard on it, you could store it on a device that never connects to the internet.
Lily Hay Newman writes about digital security for Wired.com. Steve Paulson talked with her. So in a world where everyone's being watched, what's it like to be a watcher? Coming up, the bizarre story of the Colorado motel owner who spent more than 20 years spying on his guests while they fought, slept, and had sex.
He has this obsession, and he's trying to find a way to justify in his mind. But at the end of the day, he's really, you know, f***ing off in the attic.
Yep, we're about to spoil motels for you, too. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. A couple of years ago, journalist Gay Talese published an extremely creepy book called The Voyeur's Motel. It's a true story of a motel owner who spent more than 20 years spying on his guests while they had sex. The guy's name is Gerald Foose. He owned the Manor House Motel in Aurora, Colorado, and both he and Talese are the subjects of a new Netflix documentary called Voyeur. Doug Gordon sat down with the directors, Miles Kane and Josh Corey, and I should warn you that some listeners may find parts of this conversation disturbing.
Describe for us what the motel looked like.
It had a high-pitched roof where I could walk down the middle, and I figured that's where I would build my observation platform.
Right.
They couldn't hear me. They couldn't see me, but I could hear them and see them.
Josh, let's talk a bit about what he did to be able to spy on his guests.
So Gerald bought the Manor House Motel in Aurora and retrofitted the attic so that he could use these vents that were installed as essentially a spy facility. He would crawl around in the attic space, peering down below and see couples having intercourse and disrobing, and he would catalog everything. He would write in his journals their age, what they were doing, what acts they participated in a weird way from the attic space. And this is something we try to illustrate a little bit in the film. It's almost like flipping channels to a degree. He's moving from vent to vent, seeing different experiences and living different experiences from this attic space.
Mm.
If you see this motel, it's your sort of classic drive-up 1950s era motel. Picture Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. I'm not just trying to be funny. It's surprisingly similar. It's that classic, you know, single-story drive-up motel.
Yeah. So how and when did Gay Talese, this legendary, very famous, acclaimed journalist, discover that Gerald Foose was doing this?
Gerald Foose introduced himself to Gay Talese via a letter in 1980 when Gay was at the height, arguably, of his career and the height of sort of controversy around a new book he was writing called Thy Neighbor's Wife. Was a 10-year effort to sort of document the changing sex lives of Americans. And he very famously participated in some of those events staying at a swingers commune, and it was really like the height of controversy at the time. So I think Gerald Foos saw him as his author, and he wrote Gay Talese a letter, ultimately sort of seducing him with a story I think he must have known would be too good to pass up.
Yeah, and Talese actually observed, well, because he needed to for journalistic reasons, he needed to confirm that this was actually true. So he actually went up onto the observation platform and looked through the supposed vents to observe a little bit, right?
You know, obviously, yes. As a journalist, that's what sort of was the hook, line, and sinker.
You could see light coming up from certain spots. You're hearing televisions. He leaned over one spot where there was light, and he pointed down, and we looked upon a very good-looking couple engaged in oral sex. And I leaned closer and closer, watching intently. And then I felt a man's hand on my neck. And it was the voyeur who crawled around and pulled me up, very quietly but firmly. I looked at him. And that damn tie of mine, my red silk tie, was only like a couple of feet from the head of the woman giving a blowjob to this guy on his bed. Jesus. He said, you have to be careful with that tie.
What did both of you think of Gerald Foos the first time you met him?
He's a very strange guy.
It was a highly anticipated meeting, too. I mean, of course, you hear the word voyeur, you hear man in the attic, you have all these connotations that come up with just the collective unconscious of what a voyeur looks like, and Norman Bates and all this stuff. Josh, you were there for the first meeting.
Gerald Foos is definitely a little bit different than you might expect. I mean, he's definitely creepy and comes off as, especially when he's talking about the voyeur tales, talks about it almost in this lighthearted way, which is so strange to hear.
Yeah.
But in other ways, Gerald is just looks like a, not a regular guy, but he wasn't as dark and brooding and strange as maybe, I don't know what you'd expect a voyeur who lived in the attic for 20 years to look and act like, but, you know, he was kind of jovial and he was kind of making weird jokes. And
I was picturing Gollum. A Gollum-like character.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings.
But I always describe him actually to people over the years of, you know, trying to explain to people what we're making. I always tried to describe Gerald as if Elvis had lived to his 80s. Picture that, especially when he has his hair dyed.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good description.
He has these huge glasses, which are a very big part of his look, mm-hmm. which definitely gives him a larger than life.
He's got like a Colonel Sanders vibe too.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
If Colonel Sanders and Elvis made it and had a baby, a love child, it would be...
Yeah, it's a perfect...
Yeah, if they bought a motel.
Yeah.
I had an individual come into my motel, had a bucket of chicken from the Colonel, sat down on the bed, pulled out about that thick of napkins, set them over here on the side of the bed, and then proceeded to eat this chicken. Sometimes that made me hungry. And then, of course, his hands were... What did he do? He just reached down and picked up the bedspread like this. And...
He upstairs got so angry, he said, son of a bitch, son of a bitch.
And he goes, who said that? And he went to the window, and he pulled back the drape, and he looks down this way, then he looks down that way, and nobody there.
He was not discovered, but that's the one time he kind of lost his cool.
One of the things that I find so fascinating about Gerald Foos is that he kept this very detailed document, which he calls the Voyeur's Journal, and he believes that he's doing this really important research, this groundbreaking research along the lines of Alfred Kinsey and Masters and Johnson. Also, he describes his motel as a laboratory. Do you agree with Foos's view of his voyeurism?
For us, it was important just to put that in the film because it was important for the viewer to understand how Gerald sees himself.
Yeah.
Susan Morrison from The New Yorker says very on in the film, and when Miles and I were editing the film, it was important for us to bring this quote up early.
You know, he thought of himself as a researcher. A ridiculous claim. I mean, to me, there's never been any question that Foos is really disturbed, you know, a certain kind of sociopath who just needed the attention.
The reason that was important for us is because we didn't want the viewer to think that we were drinking the Kool-Aid in the way that we saw Gerald. We know what he did. We know that this is a sexual obsession. We don't think of him as Masters and Johnson or Kinsey. You know, this is not great research. This is strange, obsessive, detailed research. But at its core, from our take, it's all about that sexual experience.
One time, he's watching a couple that were very attractive. He's looking forward with much anticipation toward a really a good show of sex. Well, just as they were about to take off their clothes, the guy turned off the lights and the television set. And the voyeur is more than disappointed. He's angry. He's angry. They betrayed his anticipation. What does he do?
I went down the ladder and got in my car.
He puts on the bright headlights, parks it right outside the window. Then he goes upstairs. Now he can see them. The guy sees the lights blazing through the drawn curtains, and he says, some dumb bastard left his lights on.
There's that great scene with Foos and his current wife, Anita, towards the end of the film after the Voyeur's Motel book has come out, and Foos is reading a review of the book, and he's upset that the reviewer describes him as a creep.
This is pointing direct fingers at the voyeur as being just nothing but a creep.
Well, you are.
My God, Anita. I guess so.
At one point during his career as a voyeur, Gerald Foos witnessed a murder. Can you tell me a bit about that?
The murder is a moment when Gerald Foos arguably sort of crosses a line. He doesn't murder anyone directly, but he claims that he's watching a young couple, a drug dealer and his girlfriend, and he's kind of incensed by seeing these drugs sold. And as a result, when they leave for an afternoon, he lets himself into the room with the knowledge of where the drugs are hidden and destroys the drugs. And on return, the drug dealer accuses the girlfriend and
starts slapping her around. She stood up and was in his face. He just reached up and grabbed her by the neck and choked her. And pretty soon he just quit and she fell to the floor.
And you see in the film that there's some serious regret. Suddenly, the fun and games are over. You suddenly see the real weight of the consequences. And it seems as if he viscerally feels conflicted about that.
So he does in some way see himself as somewhat responsible,
yeah.
Which he clearly is.
Well, in the movie, he says, you know, I could be responsible for that. And as viewers, we're like, yeah, and or directly responsible.
There's that one moment in particular where one of you from off camera asked Gerald, if you had to do this all over again, would you still participate with this book?
Mm-hmm.
And then Gay gets upset with you.
What's wrong about this is they already asked you that question with me not there. And then with me here, they're trying to get you to answer differently, which could expose you as a hypocrite. Don't you understand this?
I understand.
This is the way journalism works.
I understand where you're coming
from. These guys
are
not even credible journalists. They're cameramen.
Was there a lot of debate between the two of you about whether or not to include this scene?
I think we knew right away that it was a pretty engaging scene. Whenever you're filming as documentarians, or at least I can speak for us, whenever we're filming, sometimes things go awry. And what's most important as a filmmaker is to kind of just keep your head and not let your emotions take control of the room and just shoot. Always record, always record.
We have Gerald Foos as our subject, and we're watching him react as Gay's subject. But at the moment that Gay blows up at us, I think we're also seeing Gay have his moment as a subject of our doc. And you're suddenly seeing him get emotional. And he's sensing a loss of control, which is what happened to his subject a few scenes ago. I mean, it is a little complicated web.
You talk about layers of voyeurism, Miles. There's this brief moment in the film in which we see Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho on one of the miniature motel TVs in one of the miniature rooms, and it's the scene of Norman Bates And he's spying on Marion Crane in her room. And it got me thinking that your film is like one of those Russian Matryoshka dolls in which there's a smaller doll contained within each doll, in the sense that Gerald Foos is watching people, Gay Talese is watching Foos, you're watching both of them while you're making the film,
yeah.
And then the audience is the final voyeur. So ultimately, yeah. Everyone is a voyeur.
The idea of people are outraged, everyone sort of states, this isn't right, voyeurism is wrong. Privacy should be respected, yet all of us in some way, obviously Gerald Foos is a more criminal version, some of us more unconscious, but we all are natural curiosity about other people's lives, I think.
But you want, as a documentarian, usually to get as candid and raw moments as possible. And the reason why you want that is because it feels voyeuristic.
Yeah. And then we'll have an additional level of voyeurism when the DVD with your director's commentary comes out. And then you'll get somebody who should get Foos and Gay to comment on your commentary. And we can just, you know, minds will explode.
Miles Kane and Josh Corey are the directors of the new documentary Voyeur, which is currently streaming on Netflix. Doug Gordon talked with them. So next, imagine what it must be like to be the victim of a voyeur. Marina Lutz doesn't have to imagine, because from early childhood, her father documented her life obsessively in photos and home recordings.
Oh, smile for me now. Atta girl. Oh, that's beautiful.
Ugh. She tells her story after this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. At the beginning of this hour, we talked about how much surveillance has crept into all our lives, often in ways we're not really aware of, and especially through our own personal devices, phones, computers, smart speakers, and TVs. And the thing is, these devices are intimate objects. They hold our most personal, even secret, lives. So shouldn't we all be feeling some sense of betrayal or even violation at discovering that they're being used to watch us? Well, hold on to that question and think about it again after this next story, which, fair warning, is disturbing. Marina Lutz grew up with a father who was obsessed with watching her. He took thousands of photos of her, shot hundreds of reels of Super 8 film. She discovered the full extent of his obsession as an adult and made an award-winning short documentary about it called The Marina Experiment. This is her story.
When I first discovered everything, I would have been 37. I had just moved back from Los Angeles, and I decided to clear out my storage space, which had all my parents' stuff in it. I came across all these boxes full of Super 8 film and reel-to-reel audio tape and loads of photographs, and my friend Jean was with me. She saw it as a treasure trove, whereas I was just in disbelief because I had no recollection of being filmed so much or being tape recorded. I didn't remember that at all. There was a Super 8 film of me when I was probably just before puberty. My breasts were starting to develop, and my father took footage of me with my head cut off. It looked like he was focusing on my developing breasts, and what I was doing was I had my cat in the shot, and I was basically torturing the cat, which I imagine was because I was trying to distract my father because I knew he was looking at my breast. But, you know, I don't know how aware I was, if I was even present in that moment. In so many ways, it feels like I might have even just have left my own body when stuff like that was going on, because I tend to still do that now when faced with something traumatic or distressing.
The idea of this tape is to tell us from beginning to end everything that happened, not for us to know, but for you to know 10 or 20 years from now.
There's a series of photographs that he took of me potty training. And some people might look at these pictures taken out of context and just say, oh, those are pictures of a child potty training.
Well, first, Marina, I think you should go pee-pee.
All right.
All right? All right. I want to take a picture. Smile for me now. Atta girl. Oh, that's beautiful.
But for me, and the reason I use them in the film, was because in that instance, and in quite a few others, there was repetitive photographing on his part of women's behinds. And when I looked at it, it was like I could feel him lingering on me longer than need be. That's what the pictures felt like. It was the male gaze that I felt from him when I saw the pictures.
What are you doing, Marina? Huh? Marina? Marina?
There was a picture of me when I wasn't even, I was probably maybe even 13 or 14, where he made me pose in white cotton underwear in a hallway in our apartment. It was the hallway outside my bedroom. And I'm obviously extremely uncomfortable and very unhappy. You know, it was very inappropriate. Why would a father be asking his 14-year-old daughter to pose in her underwear so he can take a picture? I don't think that's right.
Stand over here. I want you to say something. Talk.
Hello.
Say it.
Hello.
Don't, no. You're not supposed to touch those things, dear, remember? You're not supposed to touch the microphone. You know that?
Yeah.
You can't touch it. You gotta just talk to it. You wanna try again?
No.
No? Come here and talk to me.
I can't.
Come here, sit here.
On the audio tapes, really was a lot of bullying.
Do you know I Pledge Allegiance?
Yes. I Pledge Allegiance.
Don't sit on the table.
Let who are nice.
Yes. What else? Huh? Wait a minute, start it again now.
I mean, the memories that I had were and are, continue to be visceral. So just hearing his voice and also hearing him constantly bullying me into doing things that I didn't want to do, and hearing myself as this tiny little girl sort of weeping and not wanting to do things. In probably 2003, I started really going through the archive again and decided that in order to bring some of the material into my therapy, I needed to try to maybe use editing to put together little snippets that I could bring in and show my therapist so that she could understand how this stuff made me feel.
I understand Santa Claus said he wasn't going to bring you anything. Did he say that?
No.
What did he say?
He said, if I'm very good, he'll bring something to me.
All right.
I want to know if Santa Claus brought me a Chinese.
Now wait a minute. Let's get everything ready. Oh, there's a letter.
Here's a letter. Look at what he said.
Oh, wait a minute. Dear Marina, I couldn't get you a Chinese dress in your size. I hope you will like all the other presents I brought you, Santa Claus. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess there's no Chinese dress. Because it doesn't come your size.
Why?
Then he says I couldn't get a Chinese dress in your size. Oh. Isn't that nice that he brought you a letter? Isn't that nice?
Maybe another Christmas day he could get me a Chinese.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Doesn't that card say that?
I got a really predominantly positive reaction from a lot of people. A lot of people that had had a similar experiences, which was just appalling to me, that were emailing me and continue to email me, thanking me for providing evidence for them that this kind of behavior exists and that this kind of thing is wrong. I've also gotten not as much, but a certain amount of very angry correspondence from men who think I deserve jail time for the slander of my father and who think that I took innocent photographs and put them together in a way to make him look particularly terrible. I refer to everything in the archive as evidence because that's what it feels like to me. It's not documentation of a happy childhood. There's not one picture of my parents hugging me. There's not a film of them hugging me. There's no evidence of them ever holding me or loving me or caring about me. The pictures that are taken of me, I always am posed or looking extremely unhappy. So I guess it's evidence of a very sad childhood. I don't like the word victim, and I say that in one of the pieces that I wrote, that I prefer to think of myself as an opponent. Although, I don't know what other word to use. I guess I feel like a victim now in that I'm constantly coming up against the same challenges that I can't get past. I mean, really, all I really want, and I think it's what everybody wants in life, is to be loved. But I don't know how to let that love in, because my experience with that has been so negative that that it doesn't feel good when somebody actually cares about me. It feels terrifying.
That's Marina Lutz. She's the creator of the short documentary, The Marina Experiment. And that's it for this hour. To the best of our knowledge, comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today's show was produced by the one and only Doug Gordon. And this week, we're saying goodbye to him. Doug is moving on to host and produce a brand new podcast called Beta, which is all of the things he is. Playful, provocative, postmodern, and absolutely original. Doug Gordon joined the show about 18 years ago. He's been an integral part of shaping its sensibility, so much so that it's hard to imagine producing it without him. But remember when Stephen Colbert left The Daily Show? And at first it seemed like such a loss. And then we all discovered that what Stephen Colbert had always needed was his own show. Well, that's what this is like. We're not so much saying goodbye to Doug as we are unleashing him. Sonic and comic genius will ensue. For a taste of what's ahead, check out the Beta pilot. The link's on our website. And as always, from all of us, thanks for being here with us this week. Until next time. I'll be watching you.